Today on Against the Grain, there's no question. Global warming is here and causing serious harm. And we're on course for much worse, especially as the signatories to the Paris Accord, US aside, are not on track to meet even the insufficient targets it sets. How might that shape the politics of the future? And what might the left do to change course? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Joel Wainwright about our possible futures in a climate-changed world. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's not far-fetched to suggest that the key issue of our time is the climate crisis, given that it will shape not only the lives of generations to come, but it's changing our lives in the present. Much has been written about the magnitude of the environmental crisis, the bankruptcy of elites who have failed to take action, and the paralysis that can ensue for the rest of us, caught between the urgency of increasing climate chaos and a missing sense of collective power to rapidly change course. What might it take to shift that sense of paralysis and take effective action when the stakes are so high? That question animates an informal series we're initiating here on Against the Grain about organizing against the climate crisis. And to start it off, we welcome back the authors of a pivotal book to understand the politics and future politics of a climate-disrupted world. Joel Wainwright and Jeff Mann are the co-authors of Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future, published by Verso. In our later program, I'll speak with Jeff about the legacy of the interventionist Keynesian state and its bearing on global warming. But today, I'm pleased to be joined by Joel Wainwright, who's professor of geography at Ohio State University. Joel, before we talk about the future, it's hard not to discuss the present. The dangers of global warming have, of course, been known for decades. Why have elites done almost nothing to stop it?
That's a great question, Sasha. The short answer, which is a bit simplistic, is that it's going to be very complicated and expensive to make the changes that are necessary to decarbonize global capitalism. And so there's two different ways to approach a question like the one you asked, Sasha. So let's start by making a clear analytical distinction. When we talk about addressing climate change or solving the problem, we might be thinking in terms of what used to be called mitigation. The term that Jeff and I prefer is decarbonization. Essentially, this means stopping the mining and extraction and burning of fossil fuels, since, of course, it's the burning of fossil fuels that's changing our atmosphere and driving climate change. So that's one way to address climate change. The other way to address climate change is to adapt the way we live, acknowledging that the world that we live in is warmer and weirder as a consequence of climate change. That's a completely separate way of thinking about dealing with climate change. One of our contentions in the book is that while the premise of your question, Sasha, is correct, that elites have done a terrible job of decarbonizing the economy because it's expensive and difficult for them to do so, and in a sense, their privileges are bound up with the global system that is driven by fossil fuel energy. They have been doing a lot to adapt to a world that is warmer and weirder every day. And those of us on the left who want to anticipate where politics is going and how we might respond to the global political and economic and ecological crisis need to pay attention to those forms of adaptation.
Well, let's talk about the centrality of capitalism to the problem. How fundamental do you think capitalism is in creating the problem and then its intractability?
Oh, capitalism is fundamental to any understanding of climate change, because if you look at the data from the physical sciences, it's quite clear that the big increase in the amount of carbon in the atmosphere in the form of CO2 and CH4, or carbon dioxide and methane, begins in the 19th century when humans are burning a lot of coal and later oil and more recently natural gas, and moving the carbon from the Earth's crust up into the Earth's atmosphere. Well, that energy burning is not occurring at random, but in order to facilitate the expansion of the global capitalist economy. And this is widely recognized and hardly a debatable proposition. The interesting question is whether it's possible to take something more or less like capitalism as we have it today and to imagine it being modified relatively marginally or only slightly to bring about some outcome that's sustainable. For a long time, I think a lot of people who were liberals basically thought that with relatively minor modifications, capitalism could be made green or sustainable or what have you. But as we can see with the problem of climate change, that's proven to be extremely difficult. And for instance, it's been around 30 or 40 years now that economists have been saying, I mean, liberal mainstream economists, not Marxists like me and Jeff, liberal mainstream economists have been saying for 30 years or so that the best way to incorporate the costs and the consequences of climate change into a market economy, as they call capitalism, is to put a price tag on carbon, which is to say to recognize that there's an implicit cost with every ton of coal or oil that gets burned anywhere because it is going to create damages that will be felt by future generations. So that cost needs to be internalized in the price that people pay when they buy gasoline or electricity or any commodity that required energy to be produced. And there used to be a vibrant debate among economists about what was the most effective or efficient way to internalize those costs. Should we use Pigouvian taxes or develop a cap and trade system or so forth and so on? And those debates, interestingly, are long past because to make a huge generalization, but one unfortunately that's quite true, is that liberal capitalist nation states simply failed to put a price on carbon. And around the world today, the mechanisms that are in place to price carbon into commodities are, generally speaking, extremely low. There really are very few societies where you see a price on carbon high enough to have made any real significant impact on macroeconomic policy at all. And to the extent that you can find some places such as Germany or Denmark, the chief effect has been to shift industrial production to other capitalist nation states, notably China, where commodities are produced and then imported back to places like Denmark and Germany again. So if you factor consumption in, which of course one must do if you want to understand the consequences of a capitalist society, even those European states that have adopted relatively green liberal policies haven't seen a decarbonization of capitalism. They've just seen a shifting of where the carbon is released into the atmosphere. So what I'm trying to say in a nutshell, Sasha, is that whether we look at the long view of capitalism over the course of hundreds of years and consider its long-term trend towards increasing demand and production of energy and how that's been tied up with the fossil fuel economy, or we take a closer look at the last 30 years or so at the attempts by liberals in capitalist societies to do something that would be concrete, that would lead policy in the direction of reducing dependence on carbon emissions, we find that capitalist societies have failed. And for Marxists like Jeff and I, this is not really a surprise because it's in the nature of a capitalist society to produce very serious wealth and power inequalities. And therefore, one has to consider the interests of the elite of that society. And their interests are not going to align with those like us who are going to call for a radical decarbonization of the economy in the interests of all of humanity and the generations to come.
Would you agree with those like Naomi Klein who argue that the neoliberal period, you know, the period you're referring to over the last 30, 40 years, has that created a particular impediment to addressing something like as serious as global warming? Or as you're kind of indicating, does capitalism itself, which has obviously a much longer history than just that period, is it a situation where neoliberalism is not where we can lay the ultimate blame?
Jeff and I have great respect for Naomi Klein and her book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Against the Climate, is a really important work, and we have a lot of great things to say about it in the book. But we do take issue with Naomi Klein's perspective on one key point. In the book, she implies that the basic problem with climate change concerns timing, that it was discovered by physical scientists to be a problem at around the time that the world, ideologically speaking, became fully neoliberal, namely in the late 1970s to the early 1980s. And it's implied by her that the problem then is not so much capitalism, but the specifically neoliberal and deregulated form of capitalism that has prevailed since the 1980s. We certainly agree with her that neoliberalism has not helped and it's made things more difficult. However, we would encourage our readers to take a broader view and to look at the longer history of capitalism and to take a position then that asks whether the problem isn't simply the neoliberal form of capitalism, but rather the capitalist form of social organization itself.
And yet there are those who would point to the fact that there have been times in the past in capitalism where measures have been taken to rein in threats, be they environmental, even though there might be an economic cost to them. One example being the arch neoliberal, in fact, Margaret Thatcher, being key to an agreement that banned chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, which were creating a hole in the ozone layer. And that led to the Montreal Protocol banning CFCs in 1989. Someone might ask, well, why can't something like that be done? I mean, the problem may be bigger, but, you know, in terms of the mechanisms, if it were possible to do it at one time, why not now?
That's a great question. When we look back at the second half of the 20th century, we can see that there were a number of environmental issues that at least certain capitalist states were able to address. You mentioned one example, the Montreal Protocol on CFCs. Other examples we could point to in U.S. history might include the Endangered Species Act for all the problems that we may have in realizing its potential, or the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, all of which notably date to the early 1970s. The Montreal Protocol, unless I'm mistaken, was passed around 1981. One thing that's worth noting, Sasha, is that all of those achievements then date to roughly a 10-year period, which in reflection marks the high watermark of the global environmental movement. And one thing that we can take away from that is that the reason people like Richard Nixon in the United States or Margaret Thatcher in England adopted these positions that in hindsight look really pro-environmental is not because deep down they really wanted to. It's because there were large social movements pushing them to the left on environmental issues. So the first thing we should take away here is that we would need something like a really massive global social movement to get the powerful of the world to move on the question of climate change. But unfortunately, more to take up your question more narrowly, climate change is the sort of problem that's going to be inherently much more difficult to square up to than CFCs, partly because CFCs are an industrial product that back in the 1970s were only produced by a handful of countries, unless I'm mistaken, and even within those countries by a relatively small number of firms. So it wasn't that hard to bring the leaders of those countries together and to make an agreement that would collectively ban CFCs. By the way, recently scientists discovered that there was a new burst of CFCs released somewhere in China where mm-hmm. industrial production was sort of going on involving CFCs, but the producers who were using the CFCs were caught, and it looks like the Chinese state's going to try and rein that in because it's quite embarrassing to be caught using CFCs after the Montreal Protocol. Unfortunately, however, in the case of carbon, as is well known, whether we burn coal in India or in China or the United States or in Germany, the result is the same, namely that the carbon moves from the crust of the earth into the atmosphere. And so that means that the character of the agreement, which would be necessary to decarbonize the global economy, would have to be global. And that means you have to get elites from all over the world simultaneously to make commitments to reduce carbon emissions. And that has proven impossible. The closest we've come, of course, was first in Kyoto and later in the Paris Agreement. Famously in the case of Kyoto, with the Annex II Agreement, a majority of the capitalist nation states of the world were not bound to reduce their carbon emissions. And of course, famously, the United States pulled out of the agreement as well. So the vast majority of carbon emissions were never included under Kyoto. And additionally, many of the countries that made commitments under Kyoto failed to meet their reduction targets. In the case of Paris, the nationally determined outcomes or carbon emissions, the so-called INDCs, were established by the individual nation states which came to the table in Paris. And there's no mechanism within the Paris Agreement to enforce the meeting of those targets. Moreover, according to the calculations that have been done by various NGOs and organizations that monitor carbon emissions, even if all the nationally determined commitments for carbon pathways, even if they were all met per the Paris Agreement, we would still go well beyond the 2 degrees carbon maximum mean global temperature increase, which is ostensibly the goal of the Paris Agreement. In other words, at present, there's no binding agreement globally that is going to prevent us from moving beyond 2 degrees Celsius mean temperature increase.
Geographer Joel Wainwright is my guest. My name is Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about the very complex politics of climate change, not just now, but how climate change will change the politics of the future. Joel Wainwright is co-author with Jeff Mann of Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future. And I should say that I've also spoken recently with Jeff Mann about the dimension of the Keynesian state, the Keynesian state being what was the dominant form, how capitalism organized itself in the years leading up to the early 1970s, the rise of neoliberalism, depending, of course, in which country, but certainly in the United States. And now we find ourselves, and you write about this in Climate Leviathan, that for people, including people on the left, in many ways, what we're sort of find ourselves rooting for is a return of a Keynesian state, a state that would take the bull by the horns, would intervene in a way that neoliberal states have not into the climate crisis, and would somehow bring this crisis to a halt or slow it down significantly. And of course, the Green New Deal appears to be in that vein.
Precisely right.
So how do you see that hope about a turn to, you know, bringing back, dusting off Keynesianism, bringing it back, this interventionist state to save us from climate disaster? Why are you skeptical of that as what will save the situation?
Well, you put it beautifully before, Sasha, when you said that the crisis is experienced when the left's imagination only extends so far as Keynesianism. Because Keynesianism, it's worth recalling, was a elite liberal attempt to, quote unquote, save civilization by regulating capitalism. So if the best we can imagine is a kind of Keynesian response to the crisis of climate change, then that means that the farthest our political horizon extends is to an elite form of liberalism. That should give us pause and ask us what more radical perspectives might be warranted in the problem we face. But since you mentioned the Green New Deal, let me take that on for a second. For those who haven't already but are interested in these issues, I highly recommend that you download the brief text that's been circulating that outlines the Green New Deal legislation, which, as is well known, doesn't have much hope of passing the House, let alone the Senate right now. The text isn't very long. I think it's around 12 pages or so. What's notable when you read it is how little green or environmental language is contained in the text. There's practically nothing. It's essentially a up-to-date version of the old social democratic New Deal ideals of a regulated capitalist society, with a little bit of green language added, for instance, advocating for a smart grid and solar power and so forth. Now, so that should give us pause for two reasons. First of all, we can be fairly confident in saying that the Green New Deal is not going to be achieved, at least in the United States, anytime soon. I'm not only saying that because the Republicans control the Senate, but because, as we know, the Democratic Party has its own inertia, to put it mildly. But more generally, even if something like what's called the Green New Deal were to come to pass in the United States, even that vision doesn't seem to have anything within it that could decarbonize the U.S. economy with anything like the rate which scientists are calling for. So that is to say, there's a considerable gap between the left imagination and what the scientists are demanding. So stepping back a little then, where does this leave someone on the left who might really want to act right now to address climate change, but who faces this political reality? I don't think Jeff and I are in the business of telling people what to do, and we certainly in our book don't offer a blueprint for action. But one of the reasons we wrote the book was precisely because we felt the left was stuck in this impasse between the limitations of the present political horizon or imagination and what would really be necessary in order for us to have a more radical and capacious understanding of where we're going in a world of capitalism and climate change. So to come to the central argument of the book, our contention is that, in fact, we can be reasonably confident that in the years ahead, global capitalism will persist and will continue to be the dominant way of organizing social life everywhere. But that global capitalist system is going to be increasingly rocked by a series of threats and challenges and indeed crises of an ecological but also a political and economic sort. And that what can be expected over time is that the elite of the world will try to adapt the political and economic system with which they rule in order for them to be able to sustain their privileges and their power. And this is going to mean that democracy, as it's been known, is going to become increasingly threatened. So in a sense, then, climate change isn't just about species loss and the rise of sea levels and threats to people all over the world, but particularly poor people and of course, all generations to come. But in addition, it's a threat to the things that we gained in the 19th and 20th century through the long struggle of people everywhere to establish relatively more democratic spaces and possibilities within capitalist society. An achievement, obviously, which is a long way from being fulfilled. So in sum, to come back to your question, the real problem for us with the Green New Deal is not only that it may not even pass as a piece of legislation, but that it falls far short of what's needed. And what we would call for instead is a broader and more radical perspective on where the world is going so that we can come up with mass movements capable of changing the political and economic coordinates of the world to come.
And we'll loop back to the implications for radical movements, for the kinds of movements that you think are necessary to really fundamentally address the sources of climate change in capitalism itself, and the implications, too, of a kind of green Keynesianism for perhaps limiting and constraining those radical movements. But let me ask you about, since you're saying, and this is a fundamental argument of the book, that the climate crisis, the ecological crisis, is not just going to change nature into the future, but it's going to change politics.
That's right.
And you trace a number of different scenarios, including a radical one, and looking at ways you think that politics will be reshaped. And let's start with the one that you think is the most likely, and that is what you call Climate Leviathan. In fact, that's the name of the book. What is Climate Leviathan? How do you picture it coming to pass, and what is its connection to the present?
The book is titled Climate Leviathan, partly as a homage to Thomas Hobbes, the famous political philosopher of the early modern state, who adopted a kind of speculative philosophical position during a time of great civil war, when it was uncertain what sort of society, if any sort of society, would be possible to live in the future. Typically, those of us on the left do not regard Hobbes as a useful starting point for our thinking. Jeff and I adopted a kind of Hobbesian position when we set out to do this work, in part because we find that with climate change, more and more people seem to be thinking like Hobbesians in the sense of projecting into the future a world in which life is nasty, brutish, and short, and only a powerful sovereign can save us. And we wanted to ask the question how it might be possible in a more rigorous and coherent way to ask questions about where the world is going politically today in the face of rapid climate change. And so this brings me to your question about the scenario that we describe as Leviathan. Although I might prefer the word path instead of scenario. The path called Leviathan is a world of the future in which the world remains capitalist, but the organization of elite responses to climate change has caused what we call the adaptation of the political, or a changing of the basic political coordinates of the world, to allow for the formation of planetary sovereignty, which would be a form of sovereignty that, historically speaking, would exceed its Westphalian bases. That is, it would no longer be, strictly speaking, tied to a given territory and a people. So to make a long story short, in the modern world, typically we think of a sovereignty as defined by a relationship between a given ruler or and a people who are ruled. And the people is typically defined in terms of a given territory, often a language, and having some kind of common ties to one another and to the ruler. In other words, sovereignty is, if not organized around a given territorial state, is organized around a people. And what we're projecting is a world in which sovereignty increasingly comes to be defined on a planetary basis, which would mean, in a word, that the rulers of the world would be acting in the name of life on Earth, not just a given people or a given place, but would be managing life on Earth effectively. And so the scenario we describe of as climate Leviathan is one where forms of planetary sovereignty have become realized in a world that is still capitalist. And the argument that we're making in the book, Sasha, is that while such a world does not yet exist, it is imminent, meaning that it is coming to exist. And it's already, in a sense, hegemonic, meaning that among liberal elites who take climate change quite seriously, to generalize, they anticipate a world that will need to be managed in the future. And they're already trying to prepare themselves and prepare power in the world in such a way that will allow for the emergence of a Leviathan that will then sustain their privileges. But this is by no means certain. It's a prediction. It's a hypothesis that we're making. We think it allows us to understand a little more clearly what's going on in the world. But we're not suggesting that this is a sure bet, that it's certain to happen. Because for one thing, Leviathan is already beset with its own internal contradictions, some of which we've already discussed in this interview. But moreover, there's the problem that what we call Leviathan is presently in a kind of global conflict with its historical enemy, which is what we call Behemoth, which represents a position in defense of capitalist organization of society, but opposed to the emergence of planetary sovereignty. And in the world that we live in today, we don't have to look far or think hard to imagine what figures like Behemoth look like, because, of course, the United States today is governed by Donald Trump. And in the case of Brazil now, we have Bolsonaro. Notably, both of these figures and many, many authoritarian right-wing populist figures who have taken power in the last 10 years are essentially climate denialists and have used climate change as one of their main tools to try and whip up their base. And often this is quite confusing. Like, what's the tie between right-wing authoritarian neoliberal populism on one hand, and on the other hand, denial of climate change? But in fact, we can understand it quite clearly when we accept the proposition that intuitively all those leaders, but more importantly, the political movements behind them, think of the consolidation of something like planetary sovereignty as an opponent which they're fighting against. Now, obviously, if we had to choose, Leviathan is far superior to Behemoth. And that explains why most of your listeners, I imagine, would say, well, I'd rather have someone like Bernie Sanders running the country than Donald Trump. That's why I'd rather have the Green New Deal than no carbon policy, to put it even more concretely. But what Jeff and I are asking is, can we really expect something like the Green New Deal, or more generally, to think even farther into the future, a world that is governed by elites who are trying to save life on Earth through the global regulation of capitalism? Can we really expect them to achieve the goals of the left historically, namely equality and the liberation of all? Or even more narrowly, can we expect them to address the climate and species loss crisis? And our answer is no. So that's why we're trying to offer a framework in which the left can think more deeply about what other possibilities might exist.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today I'm joined by one of the two authors of Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future that's published by Verso. And I'm joined today by Joel Wainwright. He teaches geography at Ohio State University, and his other books include Israel and Palestine, Marxist Perspectives. So what role do you see the U.S. potentially playing in the Leviathan scenario? You mention in your book, the writing of John Holdren, who became an advisor to Barack Obama, who had written a book with the Ehrlichs of the population bomb fame about the need for a planetary regime. If such a regime were to come to pass, this scenario of a global supergovernment of some kind, which, of course, as you say, people on the populist far right, it's certainly their nightmare, right? If it were to come to pass, how do you picture the role of the United States and also of China?
That's a difficult question, Sasha. We try to take it up in chapter 6 of our book, where we flesh out the theory of planetary sovereignty, and we describe a number of what we might characterize in the terms of international relations, or IR, as geopolitical scenarios that could give rise to forms of planetary sovereignty. You've identified correctly the two most important capitalist nation states in these scenarios, the United States and China. If I could return briefly to your question earlier about Naomi Klein, you may recall that Klein's hypothesis is that part of the reason the world has not addressed the problem of climate change is that we discovered what was driving the problem and what we had to do about it at precisely the moment that the world became neoliberal. Another version of this hypothesis might go as follows, that the part of the reason the world has had such a great difficulty in confronting the problem of climate change is that the major global agreement that would have to be forged is occurring at a time of change of hegemon in the world system, where clearly now the United States is in its long-term decline, or in the so-called terminal phase of the decline of the hegemon, but China has not yet arrived at a position where it is acting as a new hegemon ordering a new system. In other words, we're kind of in an interregnum where neither the United States nor China alone are the ordering hegemon of the world system. And as a consequence, in these periods historically, which have occurred around three or four times in the long history of capitalism, there tend to be many conflicts between would-be hegemons and also the various nation states that sit underneath the top tier of the global system. And we think that we're in such a phase now, and unfortunately the most likely scenario is that that means there's going to be continued conflict between these different actors. And in fact, we could say that many of those conflicts are playing out now. It's just that they play out in a way that's like a Cold War. So for instance, today we can see an arms race that's occurring between the United States and China, particularly in the Pacific Ocean, where all around China, the United States has been building for 70 years or so an archipelago of empire, a whole archipelago of naval bases and spaces where the U.S. can launch principally air attacks all across Asia if necessary in an effort to contain China. And now finally, after a long period of growth and development and change, China has established its own navy and is establishing its own bases and is really pushing back against the United States. And by the way, the U.S. policy towards China in this regard, the effort to contain and control and to build up bases around China, has been remarkably consistent across both Republican and Democratic administrations. So this isn't just a John Bolton thing, far from it. So now back to your question, what role does the United States play? Well, let's imagine a scenario where the United States made a strategic or technological breakthrough with respect to one of the forms of technological weaponry which are currently under development here in the United States in an effort to sustain our hegemony vis-a-vis other competitors, but especially China. There's a couple of potential areas here, but AI is one. Space weaponry is another. There's various fields of technological development that have clear military applications, which the Pentagon is investing a lot in today. If the United States made a qualitative breakthrough in one or another of these areas, and so that it was in a position where it sustained a decisive military advantage over China for the next 30, 40, 50 years, It's possible that the United States could then become the center of a new climate leviathan, but it wouldn't necessarily be the United States per se that would be at the center of the table. It might be a subgroup of elites of the United States who act in the name of elites around the world. In such a scenario, what we think of as the United States empire of the 20th century would be extended into the future, but would increasingly have a kind of green tinge or planetary equality. By contrast, the opposite could be the case. It could be that China beats the United States to the next round of powerful weapons development, essentially leapfrogging over the United States and becoming the world's leader with respect to AI plus communications plus space-based weaponry, in which case China could be in a position to organize a kind of planetary sovereignty. Or in a third scenario, it could be that China and the United States somehow set aside their differences because of the global threats presented by climate change and crises of global capitalism, and establish essentially a new form of empire where elites of China and the United States collaborate to build a new form of sovereignty. Any of those scenarios are possible. We don't claim to predict which it will be, but we think that some version of these changes is likely, although it may well take decades to work itself out. And if the previous three centuries are any guide, there will probably be, unfortunately, considerable conflict and war before we arrive at some new stable configuration like a climate leviathan.
Well, staying with China, let's talk about another of the paths that you trace, which is what you call climate Mao. Now, this is not the capitalist China version. This is an authoritarian socialist state that might emerge in the face of climate change. You write that this kind of path, were it to appear, would be likely to be Asia-specific. So tell us about what climate Mao would look like and how might it emerge?
Sure. First, just a clarification, because when we talk about China and the United States, there's often a lot of confusions about some basic questions like, what is China today? Is it communist, or is it capitalist, or is it something else? So let me start with just one or two brief clarifications, and then I'll respond to your question, Sasha. So in our view, despite the fact that the Communist Party of China runs China today as a one-party state, China is a thoroughly capitalist society today. And so in terms of its economic and social organization, is not really so different than the United States, although, of course, it's a bit unusual that the state is the largest collective capitalist actor. But there are some historical precedents for that as well. But so clearly, if China is a capitalist nation state today, it's not building what we call climate Mao. On the contrary, China is, in fact, or rather the elites of China today, are major actors globally who are inching the world in the direction of what we call climate leviathan. But as I explained in answer to the previous question, how exactly we'll get there remains far from certain. But you've asked about the scenario we call climate Mao, which is a force in the world that we don't really see as yet, but is a potential scenario that could emerge on the left in the future. So to put it formulaically, climate Mao would be a scenario where planetary sovereignty does come to emerge, but not in a world that is trying to defend the capitalist organization of social life, but in fact in a world that is organized on a communistic or anti-capitalist basis of some sort, perhaps a sort that we haven't yet seen. How in the world could that ever come to pass? Well, let's imagine China 10 or 20 years in the future as the center of a Asia-centered global economy. China would be the world's leading producer and consumer of most commodities at that point, and indeed they are already, and the world's largest emitter of carbon. It'd be the world's largest population center. It'd have the most powerful military in the world, potentially. If a revolution were to occur in such a society, which seems far-fetched today, but we have to remember that there are potentially hundreds of millions of people in China who are going to be severely impacted by the changes of climate change. And we should also bear in mind that although China has enjoyed now three decades of spectacular growth, there are some very fundamental social, economic, and political problems in China, which the Communist Party has done a, you know, reasonable job of trying to stabilize and confront through a variety of means, including some that are increasingly authoritarian, and which certainly we're not trying to defend. I don't mean to say it's done a good job in a moral sense, but I mean to say that it has been able to maintain some stability. But we have to be careful not to presume that China as it exists today will be stable forever. And it's possible to imagine that at some point China will change quite radically. And there is a living legacy of Maoism all across Asia, but of course most especially in China. And if there were to be something like a revolution in China in 10 or 20 years, and the masses were to radically transform their society and take hold of that state, it could become the center of an entirely new world system. And so it's also important to remember that the left is not only potentially in existence in China, but everywhere in the world. I mean, there's always possibility of radical change. And Maoist visions of change can be found all across Asia, from India to North Korea to Southeast Asia today. So it's possible that something like a newly rediscovered and reinterpreted conception of Maoism could serve as a kind of rallying point for heterogeneous groups of people all across Asia, and from there transform the entire world system. It's not a likely scenario, we admit, but it's one that we think will probably become increasingly attractive to people in the future as it becomes clearer and clearer that climate change is becoming more and more severe and that the liberal capitalist elites are clearly failing to decarbonize global capitalism.
Well, Joel Wainwright, and I should say I'm speaking with one of the co-authors of Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's talk about a fourth path that you trace out as a possible future. And this is the one that you call Climate X. You mentioned earlier in the program the possibility of radical movements from the bottom up, rising up in response to ever-increasing climate catastrophe. How do you see this path, Climate X, and how would it differ from what you've just been talking about, Climate Mao?
Perhaps I could start by saying a few words about why we wrote this book, because your question gets to the heart of the motivation that Jeff and I felt when we started working on this project 10 years ago.
Sure.
If we go back to 2009, you may recall that after Barack Obama had been elected in the United States in 2008, there was a surge in environmental activism around the world, particularly organized around the idea of creating a new international agreement to mitigate carbon. And it came to a head in the fall of 2009 in the run-up to the 2009 UN Climate Change Conference, or the Copenhagen Summit, as it was called, which took place in December of 2009. Jeff and I were both, at that time, active in events that took place in the cities we live in. I'm here in Columbus, Ohio, and Jeff lives in Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada. And we were both asked to speak at different events for different reasons about the Copenhagen Summit and about essentially the question, what should the left be asking for? Should we, if we're trying to make demands on liberal elites here in Copenhagen, what is it we're fighting for, really? And Jeff and I essentially said in different ways that we needed to have a vision of change that went far beyond what was on the table in Copenhagen. And I guess you could say we tried to throw cold water on the naive hopes of many liberals who were present that the elite were going to come together in Copenhagen and come up with an agreement that would save us. And something Jeff said that day really got us thinking. He stood up in Vancouver and he said, we're either going to get a climate Leviathan or we're going to get a climate Lenin. And those are our options. And obviously what we need is something more like a revolutionary scenario. In other words, he advocated for a kind of Leninist revolutionary strategy to confront the problem of climate change. And the irony there is that Jeff and I are not really committed Marxist-Leninists, and far from it. I mean, we're kind of unorthodox Marxists, actually. But we got stuck on this metaphor. We said, what does this mean, climate Leviathan? Intuitively, I knew just what he meant, and we had to confront this question. And through a series of conversations, we realized that we had a kind of intuitive sense of what capitalist elites were aiming for in Copenhagen and more generally in the world. And we knew we opposed it, but we also recognized that for many on the left, and not only in the United States and Canada, and including those who were fighting for climate justice, the question of what we were fighting for and what we really wanted was extremely vague. And I might add, Sasha, and I say this with all sympathy to my friends and comrades on the left, and this is not intended, therefore, as a judgment, but 10 years later, I still feel deeply, like very frequently, when those of us on the left speak about climate change, even though we might be really clear about who we're criticizing or what we don't like, we're still extremely vague about what we're fighting for and what our vision of an alternative is. And that should be taken as symptomatic. It's not a failure of any individual. It's rather a more general crisis that we have on the left, a failure to really grasp the depth of the situation and produce a collective alternative vision. And that was really what led us to write this book. In other words, it all started with a kind of self-critique. We didn't really know what we were arguing for. And so that led us to step back and try and sketch out these future scenarios, which we walked through earlier in this interview. But it all brings us back to this question, which now you've asked, which is, well, what exactly are we fighting for? So in the book, we conclude the final two chapters are an attempt to sketch a radical utopian scenario, which is opposed to climate Leviathan, but of course also climate behemoth, and neither is it climate Mao. And we call it climate X. We call it climate X in the first instance because X is a variable that you solve for in mathematics. It's a term, therefore, a sign that one can use when one indicates that you don't know exactly what it is yet. You're trying to figure it out. We also wanted to avoid a situation where we called it something like climate communism or solar socialism, and then immediately fall into debates over, well, what is the meaning of socialism and communism, which, while important, are not always helpful, if you know what I mean. Sure. Sometimes you just have to bracket those questions so that you can focus on a different issue, and that's what we tried to do with the concept of climate X. But what is this climate X, and how can we even think about realizing it? To put it formulaically, climate X would be a world where, on one hand, we have overcome or transcended capitalism and established some sort of post-capitalist society which is based on a different, more equitable, and genuinely liberatory way of organizing economic life, which I suppose you could call socialism or communism, but again, we're bracketing that for now. And at the same time, has avoided falling into the trap of creating a planetary sovereignty, while also, we say, transcending the contradictions of the existing Westphalian form of sovereignty we associate with the territorial nation state. In other words, to put it more simply and dropping the jargon, climate X would be a world where we've had a thoroughgoing revolution that is so profound that everything about political and economic life has become far more profoundly liberatory and equal. And we make the claim in the book, and this is in a sense the big conclusion of the book, that it's really only in such a world that we can imagine something like a genuinely just response to the problem of planetary climate change. So how are we going to do that? I think that was really what you were asking, Sasha, is like, how do we build Climate X? And unfortunately, the answer is that it's really hard to imagine that happening soon. And certainly many readers of our book have walked away from the conclusion feeling like we gave some really cool examples and maybe pointed to some fun illustrations or gave people some clues of what we're advocating for, such as boycott and divestment and strike and rebuilding alternative economies and so forth and so on. But I think to make a generalization, one criticism of the book is that we have been insufficiently concrete in this part of the book. And I think that's an entirely fair criticism, to which ultimately our only response is to say, we on the left have an enormous amount of work to do. And the failure of the conclusion of our book is not just the failure of two intellectuals, but more generally a reflection of the fact that we on the left have a huge amount of work to do to be able to realize such alternatives.
Well, let me end by asking you, and we only have 2 minutes, how do you think that the other paths, the prospect of climate Mao, which quite a few people on the left, even on the radical left, are looking to longingly as
they're endorsing it for sure.
Yeah, as a hope, right? As a hope that there might be that versus climate behemoth. But how does that prospect of climate Mao and the other prospect of climate Leviathan in its green Keynesian version constrain the emergence of the kind of radical movements and perhaps radical thinking, what you're touching on here, this crisis of the imagination that has, one could argue, beset the left before the climate crisis became apparent, but has really profoundly taken hold during it?
That's right. Well, that's well said.
How do you think those factors into the future might be obstacles for the emergence of that imagination and the movements along with it?
That's a great question. I'm afraid I don't have a brief answer for you. All I can say is that you've put your finger on a question that we hoped our readers would ask after reading the book. And we hope that readers of the book walk away asking questions like this and feel re-energized not only to do the important work of trying to stop the creation of new sites of burning, extracting and burning fossil fuels, but also to take on the more profound task of reimagining the world so that we don't accidentally sleepwalk into a scenario where the left contributes to the formation of new forms of oppression. Such would be reflected by climate Leviathan. But perhaps I could just read the last paragraph of the book and then we can end it there because it addresses this question.
Sure.
If we bundle together all the most radical strategies of the climate justice movement today, mass boycott, divestment, strike, blockade, reciprocity, bundle them all together and you will glimpse Walter Benjamin's vision of another world where natural history and human history intersect in the moment of transience. This glimpse may seem too imprecise a way to close this account. However, because the account is in fact not closing, but only just opening, we prefer to see it as a politically and analytically responsible gesture in radically uncertain times. Our planetary crisis is, among other things, a crisis of the imagination, a crisis of ideology, the result of an inability to conceive any alternative to walls, guns, and finance as the tools to address the problems that loom on the horizon. Our task is to see the ruins and fragments of our natural historical moment for what they truly are, and not to draw up blueprints of an emancipated world, but to reject Leviathan, Mao, and Behemoth while affirming other possibilities. What remains? All we have and all that we've ever had, an X to solve for and a world to win.
And that's Joel Wainwright. He is the co-author of Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future. He's also the author of Geopiracy and Decolonizing Development. Joel co-authored Climate Leviathan with Jeff Mann, and we'll be airing our interview with Jeff Mann as a pair, along with this interview with Joel Wainwright. Joel, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Sasha. It was really a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.